We are in Habakkuk chapter 1. We're going to be looking at God's first response. We started it last time we were here. Habakkuk has brought a complaint. He's complaining about his society. There's oppression. There's social injustice. Bribery wins the day. People, they've lost control. In fact, you can see there's six words he uses in verse chapter 1, verse 3. Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. That's what's going on in society. There's violence. It's Hamas, social injustice or social oppression. There is strife and conflict. That's the result, potentially, of the destruction in society and the social oppression in society, is that creates strife and conflict. And then that causes then people begin to go to the law and look for court cases and some way to get their fair share. And that's in verse 4, therefore the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. Meaning there's no resolution. We just have got destruction and social oppression. People are angry and upset and there's strife. They go to court. They try to get their fair share, get the thing set back on track. The court system is paralyzed. Nothing's going to restore this. Humanity cannot restore this society. And so it says there, the wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. You're never going to get it taken care of. The elite are winning, and everyone else is being oppressed. And so Habakkuk's complaining. It's a just complaint. It's a fair complaint. God doesn't rebuke him for complaining because, one, he shows faith in going to God saying, we've got this wrong in our culture. But what Habakkuk is not ready for is God's response. And here is God's response beginning in verse 5 going to verse 11. We'll look at that tonight. And his response is, I'm going to bring in the Babylonians to correct this. And Habakkuk's response to that will begin in verse 12. Is like, I can't understand this. This is amazing. In fact, God tells him, in chapter 1, verse 5, what we looked at last week, look at the nations and watch. When he says, look at the nations, he's talking about a whole world perspective. It's not just the Jews. The Lord is the God of the Jews, and the Jews are under a covenant. They realize this. Sometimes they forget that God is also the God of the entire world, of all the nations. And God being the God, the Lord of all the nations, is not like a second thought. It's not like the B team. And again, we almost need to stop and remind ourselves of this. The nations are not like a plan B. It's not the JV. The nations were that is the entire purpose of God's plan. In fact, Israel being called, Abram being called, and a nation being formed by Abraham was the very purpose of Abraham, was to reach the nations. And so when we look at this, God's looking at the world in the beginning of Genesis, and they've all gone astray, the Tower of Babel, the flood, and they've all gone astray. How am I going to get the nations back? He goes to Abram, so I'm going to use Abram and make a nation out of Abram. I'm going to bless Abram. And a lot of times that's where it stops. And we're going to bless Abram. Okay, Abraham is the chosen nation. Everything else is just washed out. No, the reason he's choosing Abraham is because through Abraham and his nation, he's going to now reach the world. So God has never taken his eye off the world. He just chose a nation to use a nation to keep his name in the earth, to bring about the Messiah, to reveal through the prophets and the church his purpose so that the world might be reached. So this, again, this very first statement, verse 5, look at the nations and watch. Why would an Israeli prophet, a Jewish prophet, need to look at the nations? I mean, it's all about Yahweh and Israel. No, you look at the nations. And be utterly amazed. In other words, he's ain't going to be able to understand what is taking place. For I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. In fact, God is going to tell him, and Habakkuk is going to be amazed, astounded. And I mentioned last time, Habakkuk indeed sees a problem, but it's a small problem when you consider the entire world situation and the fallen state humanity is in. It's a problem in Israel society. It's a problem in Judah, Jerusalem. And God recognizes this, and Habakkuk just wants God to fix this problem. But God is looking at a much bigger picture, seeing a much bigger problem, a problem that Habakkuk can't even wrap his mind around. So God is going to need to bring a bigger answer, an answer that Habakkuk can't even understand because he doesn't even understand the problem. And so when he tells him this, he's being sincere. God is being sincere, not being sarcastic or trying to be funny. But it's like, I'm going to tell you what I'm doing. I'm going to fix this problem, But I'm looking at the entire world. In fact, I'm going to use the world to solve this problem because this is a universal situation. It says, you would not believe even if you were told. Again, there's nowhere in here that Habakkuk does not have faith. Habakkuk has faith. He trusts God. He's going to God. He's just filing a complaint. In a sense, he's offering up one of his prayers or a petition. And remember, this is in the plural. God is going to respond to him when he says, you look. He's saying that in the plural. Habakkuk is not just a one man talking to God. Habakkuk is a prophet speaking for the nation to God, and God is addressing Habakkuk in the plural, meaning I'm addressing your entire nation on this. In other words, take this and show the people. He says, I'm going to do something that you would not believe. You all of you would not believe, even if you were told, and I'm going to tell you. And again, Habakkuk's got faith. But God is not going to give him like the genie in the bottle answer and solve the problem. He's going to give Habakkuk more information, more revelation, more insight. And Habakkuk is going to have to be content with more information, more revelation, more insight. And that is really what God does many times in the scriptures. And it's probably his modus operandi. Instead of just snapping his fingers and solving your problem, he allows you to grow and see a bigger picture and gain more understanding so you can continue in faith, because this is the book that says the righteous will live by faith. The righteous is not going to live by having their prayers always answered. The righteous is not always going to live because they see miracles. The righteous are going to receive more information to have greater faith, and you're going to continue in this faith because God has got a bigger plan than your little world going on. I want my problem solved. God says, you know, and sometimes you have an instant response. Sometimes it happens in your lifetime, an answer. But all of your problems are going to be resolved in God's big plan. That is biblical. So anyway, he says this, you would not believe even if you were told. Verse 6, and this is kind of where we'll start here tonight. I am raising up the Babylonians or the Chaldeans. And as we see on this chart, we've looked at it many times. You've got the decline of the Assyrian Empire happening during Ashurbanipal's reign during the first 40 years. It was successful. They were still expanding. But about halfway through, their borders started to shrink. Nineveh used to be very safe, tucked way back into the depths of the Assyrian Empire. No one would ever be able to travel that far. No army is ever going to invade all the way through the Assyrian Empire to get to Nineveh, so they're safe. But by the time of the end of Ashurbanipal, their kingdom, their borders had crunched in. Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar's father, is putting pressure on them, and they're feeling heat from the north, from the east, from the south, from Babylonians. And we've got three very weak kings, and we know the story. These guys, they retreat from when Nineveh falls in 612, they retreat to Haran, and in 610, they retreat back to Carchemish. That's just the government. It'd be like, you know, whatever remains, the society's gone, the people have been scattered, but their leaders, their government, you know, their Congress, the Pelosi's and Schumer's, they're just retreating to Haran, and then the Carchemish trying to maintain some kind of control of their power. Then finally, in 605 at Carchemish, Babylon destroys them. This is probably being written sometime before Carchemish. Habakkuk, you know, before maybe 606 is what I've got on here. But the Babylonians are indeed a rising power. Now, an important thought on this, because it's going to come up in our right here. God is going to give him, and again, I counted them, and you're going to be able to count them. I didn't read a commentary that said 23 descriptors. And so, I mean, you could probably argue about that or describe that. I can say 21 descriptors, and one of them is about their horses, which then uses three descriptors to describe their horses. So if you want to use, you know, see, I mean, you'll see what I'm talking about here. But God is going to describe these Babylonians. But one of the first things he's going to call them is bitter and hasty. They are a bitter and hasty people. And that's not just a statement about human nature that, you know, the sinful man is bitter and sinful man is hasty. These Babylonians, just as you've got cultures that develop, I mean, we're in the midst of a culture ourselves, and people in our society, in our culture, respond a certain way because they've been programmed through past events, if it be their childhood. And I'm not talking about parenting, I'm talking about how society has raised them. I can say this very confidently. We are a soft, passive, easily frustrated society. That's who we are. We are a people, a weak people that when push comes to shove, we'll just give up and follow the crowd. You go back to maybe the early days, you know, the 1700s, we were a people who were willing to fight for our rights. There's a great song, You Gotta Fight for Your Right. I'm not sure if you know the song. But it's not a positive song, but it's kind of a funny song because where's the rock and roll generation gone? But different societies develop, and we've developed ourselves into a weak culture. We've been trying to get rid of masculinity. It's almost like being a man is an offensive thing. Men should be more like women. Well, then why do women want to become like men? Because women, it's like, well, what is going on? We're completely confused. So we could have a description of ourselves and every culture. But God is going to describe them, and we'll see early on here, as a bitter and a hasty people. And one of the reasons is they've been under the dominance of the Assyrians during this entire time. The Assyrians went down and conquered, even burnt Babylon one time. They placed their Ashurbanipal's brother was placed as the king of Babylon for a while, and he had trouble. So the Babylonians have been under the Chaldeans. They've been a fractured tribal community of different tribes of the Chaldeans, even fighting amongst themselves. Then the Assyrians came down and put pressure on them, and that caused them to kind of start grouping together to get rid of the Assyrians. That's where Nabopolassar comes in, and they just know that they're tired of being oppressed. They're bitter with history. They're bitter with how they've been treated. They've got now Nabopolassar who's marching off, and they're hasty, meaning they're just, you know, impulsive the way they respond. And these descriptors that you'll hear tonight, it would be interesting just go back and you got a little insight from the Bible of Nebuchadnezzar's character trait. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar comes back after having recovered from a little battle in 605, he had to go back and retreat, and then he came back over into the Middle East. And when he comes back to meet with the trainee, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it was during that time he has a dream and he wants it interpreted. And when they can't interpret it, he says, you tell me the dream, you know the story. You tell me the dream. They say, we don't know the dream. He says, well, if you can't figure out the dream, I'm not going to just tell it to you and have you lie to me. And so when they can't do it, he just says, I'm going to kill y'all. That's an example of just, I mean, have you thought about this? Tell me the dream. We don't know the dream. Okay, you're all going to die. He was hasty. He was bitter. He was suspicious of the wise men. He was bitter towards them when they couldn't do what he wants. Just let's think about what should we do? How do we resolve this situation? We're not resolving any situation. We're just going to kill everybody. Even someone came knocking on Daniel's door, you know, they came to give him the vaccination or something. And he says, you know, well, what's wrong? They says, well, the king is having all the wise men executed. You're next. It's like, well, can we have one night? Can I at least pray? And he says, and he got the answer and went to him. And then Nebuchadnezzar quickly changed his mind. And so you can see just an example of Nebuchadnezzar being hasty, being bitter, being rash in his decisions. And that is the state of these Babylonians. And God is going to use 23 descriptors to describe the people that he's bringing up. And so when he says, when Habakkuk complains, we've got a culture that justice is paralyzed. The law is paralyzed, justice is perverted, and God says, I'm going to do something that will amaze you. If I tell you what I'm going to do, you will not be able to understand it. Watch this. And he begins to explain it to him, and Habakkuk is just blown away. And so here it is, verses 6 through 11, you're going to see 23, and again, you can count them yourself, we'll go through them, 23 descriptors. From verse 6 to 11, God's answer, all he's going to do is describe for Habakkuk the people that he's got prepared to come in and judge Judah. He knows exactly what he's been creating these people for this very moment. He knows them specifically, how they're going to act, what they're going to do. It's like they're ruthless. And you're even going to see him refer to the fact that they are a law to themselves. They have their justice is determined. It's self-determined. It's like we can sometimes say like our constitution. You know, we have certain rights because God is creator. All humans, all mankind have these rights. So we don't just say we're a law to ourselves. Our founding fathers look and says, if there is a God and he's made everyone, then everyone has some just simple rights because they are created by God. And no one can infringe upon those rights. And that, I mean, the American Constitution isn't a law unto themselves. It doesn't determine justice, whatever the king, the president, the Congress wants. There's this document that the founding forefathers established that says, these are things that we recognize. We don't get to choose. It's just the way God made it. So our culture is based on, we are not a law unto ourselves. We are a country under God. We pledge allegiance under God because He's the one who's established reality. Now, that doesn't mean we always follow it. I recognize myself as being under God, but I still outstep outside of what I know God wants me to do because I have a sin nature, and sometimes I take justice into my own hands, or I hold bitterness. It's God will decide, but yet I hold bitterness. So, I mean, I'm not talking about being perfect or even everybody in America following the Constitution, but we have a Constitution that recognizes God as having some laws that if you're not functioning under those laws, like, you just can't come into someone's house and take their stuff because that would be wrong. Why? Because we know that's wrong. I mean, it can go all the way back to because, one, it's not your stuff. They've got right to property, and it's their property. The government can't even take it. It's their property. Now, these people have, God says, they've pushed all that aside. They are a law to themselves. They're hasty, they're bitter, and they'll do whatever they want. And there's nothing hanging over their head that's going to make them feel guilty. They have no conscience in that sense. And I'm bringing them to your city to destroy you. And he's, in a sense, going to take this group of people, the Babylonians, he's going to take them off the leash. Now watch this. Take them off the leash of his sovereign oversight for a brief moment in history. It's like when a society begins to act a certain way, God will bring about warnings, judgments, and eventually destruction and removal. He will not just let you run free. There'll come a time. Even as an individual, you can go so far, but eventually you commit the sin unto death and you're removed from history. I mean, assuming you don't just live out your life. But God will let you go so far, but eventually, like, okay, we've had enough. If he's done using you, sometimes he lets people live extended lives in a state of rebellion towards him just to be a test for other people. I mean, that's basic. Why is this person still alive? Well, they're just a source of testing. And hopefully, you, me, we are people that are following God and we're not still alive simply because God's saying, yeah, I'm going to use that person just to go around and test other Christians and see how I can develop patience. And there's people like that. The Babylonians are going to be taken off the leash and allowed free reign. God is going to say, basically, he doesn't say it in those words, but they're going to be able to, nothing's going to stop them. They're going to take all the credit. They're bitter. They're hasty. They make the law when they want to, and no one's holding them account. No one's holding them accountable. Including me. I'm just going to watch. It's like, holy smokes. That's right. It is holy smokes because God is using them to, he's basically unleashing the sin nature in the Babylonians and said, go get Judah. And now when he's done, he's going to bring the reins back in. That's how we go through these empires, Assyria. Because remember, Isaiah says Assyria is the rod of God's anger. Remember, Jonah went and brought them back to a place of getting them back on track. There, right before Tiglath-Pileser, what was it, 750, 760? They're down to about a 100-mile radius. They're done. Nineveh knows they're done. Jonah brought them back. They got themselves back on track. God raised them up, and he used them to punish Northern Israel. The Assyrians are the rod of my wrath, the rod of my anger. Well, he's finished with them, and now they're being overrun by the Babylonians, but God is raising the Babylonians up to put them aside because he's going to use these 23 descriptors to overrun Judah. So here, I'm going to finally read them to you. Here we go. The NIV, then on the notes, we'll have the English Standard Version. Chapter 1, verse 5, look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe even if you were told. I am raising up the Chaldeans or the Babylonians. Now here comes the 23 descriptors, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own, meaning they're going outside of their boundaries. Nations don't do that. They're not allowed to do that. But God's letting them take them off the leash. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves, and they promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. So not only do they have the attitude, they've got the equipment to follow through on their attitude. It's kind of like that kid, you know, at school that would get angry and throw a fit, but he never had enough power or, you know, ability or strength to actually fight back, would just get mad and throw things and cry. Well, then there was the kid that had the power, the bully or whatever, the kid that when he got mad, you better look out because he's taking care of business. These people are bitter, they're hasty, they're off the leash, but they've also got the military backing to just like, let's just kill everybody. I mean, he's giving them atomic weapons. Now, you think about our world today, is God preparing a people or has a people already prepared that he's about to let off the leash and he's going to give them all the weapons they need? He's doing it right here. You say, well, God would never do that. Right here, he's got a people that they don't care what the right or wrong is. They don't even recognize right or wrong. It's what they want, and they're bitter, and they're tired of being oppressed. And God says, well, here's some very swift horses. Here's some military equipment that the Middle East has never seen before. Ho, ho, ho. Now, how do you feel? Very angry. Well, let's go get somebody. And it's like they're not even going to think. And they're going to be, well, I'll keep reading. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture swooping to devour. They all come bent on violence. They all come bent on Hamas. They all come bent on basically a superior. This is right in my Bible. I've got it written. I wrote this down many years ago. Violence or Hamas. Superior attitude toward other nations, prejudice that justifies their evil. Talk about white supremacy or racism or whatever you're talking about. That was within that word Hamas. Is they have an attitude that we are superior to any of the other races, and whatever we do to those races, or if you're in a society and you're the elite, you've got the money, you've got the power, you've got the political offices, we can justify, we are superior. It may not be a racial superiority, but it is an elite social standing superiority. We deserve this, but you don't deserve this. Based on what? I mean, my own judgment. Clearly, I am superior because I am a member of Congress and you merely live in the Midwest. So you just put a mask on, lose your business, and stay home. Me, I'm taking and stop using gasoline. Me, I'm going to fly to my vacation island with a jet and not wear a mask, take photographs, and have the audacity to upload them to social media because why would anyone care? I am elite. And that is the word Hamas, a superior attitude. It can be racial, it can be social, and that's what happens in society when you start having Hamas, social oppression, and the people that are doing the oppression, you can't even explain it to them. You are oppressing people. You don't have to follow the rules, but everybody else has got the government, the military, coming after them because they're not following the rules that you made that you don't have to follow. Because the rules are for those people. Well, that's Hamas. That's social injustice right here. But these people, they come bent on Hamas. They think they're superior. God has let them develop a superiority complex. They're just going to overrun people, and they're going to do it with evil, and they're not even going to feel, they don't even recognize it. It's not evil if we do it to you. Now, don't do it to us. But if we do it to you, it's fair. They all come, the whole nation. They're not talking about Nebuchadnezzar. They're not talking about the generals or the trained military. The whole nation thinks this way. The whole nation is bitter. They're hasty. They've got a superiority complex, a superior attitude toward other nations, a prejudice that justifies the evil that they do. Their hordes advance like a desert wind. They gather prisoners like sand. They deride kings. They scoff at rulers and laugh at fortified cities. And all that, they scoff, they laugh, they mock, they use for sport. If it's a king, if it's the government officials, if it's, you've got a fortified city, you've got a fortification, we'll just roll right over it. They mock it. They use it. Hey, look, I hope this one's bigger than the last one. The last one really wasn't much of a struggle. Oh, look. And they make a sport out of military. They deride kings, they scoff at rulers, they laugh at fortified cities, they build earthen ramps and capture them, the cities. In other words, they just roll up and build a ramp, and we'll talk about that. I've got some pictures. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on. It's like, what did you want us for? I don't know. We just wanted to destroy you and burn it too. We're going to go burn something else. It's like, I mean, what was your motive? Were you trying to get a strategic position? Sometimes, but sometimes it's just like, boy, that's a big wall. Let's burn it down. And it's like they just invade. They're not necessarily thinking through this. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on. Guilty men whose own strength is a God. Now, in all of this, God says, oh, they're guilty. Oh, I just described it. They're ungodly. They're guilty. But their own strength is their God. Now, that's a tough verse to translate. Their own strength is their God. Or they give God their credit. And we'll talk about that as we get there. But basically, they're guilty, but they're not going to stop. They give the credit to their gods, or they think their strength is their God. We'll talk about that verse when we get there. Anyway, within there are 23 descriptors. Now, on page 2 of your notes, here we go. We've got the English Standard Version. And underneath there, just for more insight, we've got the transliteration of the Hebrew. You've got the English translation. You've got the form of speech written below it in abbreviated form. Above the English translation, you've got the Hebrew word that we can't read. I can't read. But above that, you've got the transliteration that you can sound out of the Hebrew word. And above that, you've got Strong's numbers. This is from BibleHub.com. If you go to BibleHub.com, figure out where to get this. It's interlinear. See, there's all the translations are there. You can find the interlinear. Then all those numbers and the transliterations, those are all live links. If you want to know, like, for example, look at point 2 at the bottom of page 2. The word bitter is the word hamar. And if you go up there and you can find hamar for, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, a nation. Okay, bitter. It's towards the left. You got to read it backwards. You got to start on the right and read to the left. It's the second letter, second word in. You can see hamar, bitter. If you're on your computer, you could click on hamar, H-A-M-M-A-R, click, and it'd begin to take you deeper into, I want to say dictionaries, lexicons, and the meaning of the words, and find all the places it's used, and it gets to go deeper and deeper and deeper until it's like you don't even remember where it came from. You just got to start going, click back, and try and find where you started from. But for example, down there at point 2, I've got the word bitter, hamar, and then I just looked, I just kept clicking. That's where I get the word. It means bitter or bitterness. And then I write, this society had become bitter from being under the rule and oppression of Assyria. And I think I spelled Assyria wrong. I was in a hurry. Or whatever the situation is, if it hadn't been fighting each other as tribal warfare back and forth, they become bitter. And God is raising up this bitter people. And when he says, I am raising them up, it gives the impression. He's not just like saying, here, they're going to come. But he is been preparing them. These people are been prepared, and now they're ripe for the season of the 586 destruction of Jerusalem. Page 3, top, it says, the whole nation was formed to act irrationally and strike out at anything that challenged them. Thus, Nebuchadnezzar's rash order to suddenly kill all the wise men. The whole nation has that ingrained. That's their, I know it's racist, and you shouldn't say these types of things because everybody's the same, or now one's the same, or I don't even understand what it is. But in reality, different cultures, different families, different communities, different towns even, different areas of the city develop their own kind of personality. Does this make sense? Depending on where your education, your finances, what's important to you, your past, where you came from, you have a culture. And this culture has become a bitter culture. I don't even know how to say anything anymore. But there used to be, even in northern Iowa, when I was a kid, can I say this? This is all, there was communities that were German communities. I mean, people that come over from Germany and they settled and they all had German names and they all had the same German type of religion. Then you'd have others that come over from, help me out. Holland. That's what I'm trying to think of. Holland, and they'd have the Dutch. Now they'd have a certain look. They'd have a certain religion, which would be the Reform religion, and they had a certain way. The streets were cleaner in a community that was Dutch than in, say, another community, just because that's what they brought over. It was just different, and there's different foods. And we're talking 10 miles apart. We're talking about my high school. I've got a town of 600 people, and we were conference champions in basketball and football, but we'd drive 9 miles away, and we'd play Buffalo Center, and you know Buffalo Center. But there was a different type of people there. I mean, they're still white. They still speak English. Everything, we still drink the same milk. I mean, the milkman came from Buffalo Center. It's like, you're buying your milk from a guy from Buffalo Center? It's like, you know, it's like he's not from Thompson. You know what? We don't have a milkman. You know what? You know, whatever. And it's just my whole point. You can see they become a community. Now, of course, just to end the story, because of people moving out of rural communities, we used to have like a 9 or 10 towns in our conference, and we were, like I said, the conference champions in a couple of sports. And I had some all conference honors. Which I always thought was impressive back then, because we thought Thompson was the center of the universe, our little town of 600 people, class of 21. I was president of the class my senior year. It was my turn. Now it's all consolidated. The whole conference is now made up of like 2, maybe 3 schools. And it's like you'd have to drive like, you know, 45, 50 minutes to get to another school to play them, where, you know, it was kind of like the glory days back in the 60s and 70s of, you know, just going 9 miles away. And anyway, nonetheless, I understand from that how this group of people down here, the Babylonians, can have a national attitude of bitterness, of hastiness, of just, you know, it's our turn now. We've been oppressed long enough. And you can see, you got to keep aware, because that's happening. Now, that's not just the ancient world. That's happening in our world today. There's a people somewhere, whatever, you can put this all together, that God is raising up when he's ready, and he'll take them off the leash. And they've got the attitude where they're bitter, they're hasty. And then he's going to give them the technical power, and they're just going to run rampant for as long as he wants. And then he'll cut them off when he's done using them. Okay, going back to the notes. Point B at the top of page 3. Hasty. It means they act in haste. They were impulsive. They would act without considering the facts. They act now, ask questions later. And now they're going to march through the breadth of the earth. And they're going to come bitter and hasty. Now, most militaries would have some kind of strategy. They maybe would move slowly. They'd send out spies. They'd see Moses sending out spies. Joshua sending out spies. They're kind of using a strategy. These people, it's like, what the heck? Start marching. They're hasty. They're bitter. They've got the military. And now they're just, it says right here, who march through the breadth of the earth. Just go. Make someone stop us. And now they're going out just very aggressive, attacking just flat. It's like, I can't believe they're just coming right through the front door. Yep, here they are. And now you've got to stop them. But you weren't expecting the full court press. I mean, at the start of the game, we're in the full court press. The jump ball, we're in a full court press. It's like, oh my gosh. It's like, time out. And now it's like everybody's in panic mode. And now it's working for the Babylonians. Now they become even more confident. Let's do it again. And they just start rolling. And so they're going to be moving. And that's what God said. That you can see them happening right here from right across. They're coming up. We've already talked about it, from 612, 610, 605. And they're just sweeping. Now they're going to come down. They're going to go all the way to the borders of Egypt. Nothing's going to stop them. They're marching through the breadth of the earth. To seize dwellings not their own, or another way of translating, to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. Now, the importance of this is God has established nations with borders. You have your borders. You've got your property rights within your nation. Every border, every country, every culture has rules or laws. And there's some kind of right to property. How do you determine who owns the field? Maybe the king owns all the land and the king distributes it. Well, that's the law. That's how do you get land? You got to get it from the king. or maybe you can purchase it. Well, however, you've got some kind of structure within your borders. These people are marching out of their borders, which are established by God. You get in trouble for just invading countries to expand your borders. We can see that. That's one of the sins of man. Not you can defend your borders, but just to start invading other countries to take their land and take their stuff, that's wrong. You'll be punished for that unless God says, I need you to do that. I need you just to start marching across borders. Just start taking stuff from people. And that is what they're doing. They're taking stuff that is not their own. They're taking, we're not talking about just robbing someone's, you know, microwave. We're talking about taking cities and territories and borders and land. And just you now work for us. And now you're going to start paying us tribute. Nick City, please. And they just start collecting stuff. And it's like, you have no right to do this. Except God is saying it's time, because all these places are in rebellion, including, he's talking to Judah right here, and they're coming to take your stuff. And they don't deserve it. They don't own it. It's your stuff. But I'm taking it. Now, what do you want God to do? Come down and take it from you? Guys coming in and says, just start going house to house, taking stuff and collecting it, making you live in the street. Well, God doesn't do it. He doesn't just go door to door. You can see it in Ezekiel sending out angels or something. But he's sending, the Babylonians are going to do it for him. And we can assume the same thing happens in the world today. We're not waiting, well, you know, God will be the judge. God, if God is upset, he'll do something about it. And then God shows up and says, I'm here to, it's like, no, he will use the agencies he's established, starting with the angels, going down to the rulers and authorities, going into the worldly kingdoms. In this case, Nebuchadnezzar, even Daniel tells him, Nebuchadnezzar, God has given you the whole world. It's yours. You are on the throne, and God has given you favor to rule this because he wants you to fix it. And again, when Nebuchadnezzar's time was over and the kingdom was done, the Persians came in, and it was now Cyrus's time. And God is controlling history with the nations. And so that's why you see right here, it's for Habakkuk to hear this, they're bitter, they're hasty, they're going to rapidly move across the earth, no one can stop them, and then they're going to start taking stuff that's not theirs. And God's saying, yeah, I'm the one raising them up. It's like, well, that's not, are you going to, they're guilty, but I'm using them. I'm using their, now watch, he's using their sin nature to just accomplish his purpose, which is to destroy Judah. Now, when it's all said and done, he'll come back and punish the Babylonians, but not until they're done. There are people in our government today, there are people in nations today, there are nations today that God has in position for that very purpose. They're in positions to do stupid things that aren't fair, that are against God's will, that they're taking things that aren't theirs, but they're doing it because God wants them to do it. He wants them to punish or oppress so people will turn back to him. Now, their guilt, it says right at the end, they're not going to be in heaven. They're not saints. They're not doing God's will. They're being used by God as a tool to do what he wants done, but that's still they're still responsible for their sin. Can you separate that? If you can separate that, they're sinful. God is going to let their sin and their human nature come off the leash to accomplish what he wants. Their behavior is not his will, but he's going to use their sin nature to accomplish a bigger purpose. Habakkuk be told, I'm going to tell you what I'm doing, and it will astonish you. You will not believe it if I told you. I'm raising up the Babylonians. They're bitter. They're hasty. Nothing's going to stop them, and they're going to take things that aren't their own. I'm raising them up to do that. So you're making them sin? No. They're going to sin anyhow. But instead of stopping their sin, I'm going to say, hey, come over here and sin. I'm going to control where they sin. And they're guilty, so I'll punish them. But not until they've punished you for me. It's like, well, would God do that? Well, explain Satan. I mean, Satan, that's the whole ministry of Satan. Satan, the lake of fire for you. Good. So where's he at? Oh, he's roaming around the earth, seeking whom he might devour. What? I mean, if I was God, I would, it's like, he's been assigned to the lake of fire, he's been prepared for the devil and his angels. Okay, well, let's get him in there. Oh, not yet. Because I'm going to use him in history. They're definitely going there, but I'm going to use their rebellion to direct. I mean, that it's like, wow, that's like a genius. That's like a, how do you say I'm out of my league right here? You start talking about martial arts, people that are using, and that you hear them say, use their own body weight against them, use their own momentum against them. And again, I can't do that, but you can imagine, you know, how you see movies, and that's all staged, of course, or even martial, you know, not the cage fighters and stuff. But they're trained to use someone's momentum for their own advantage. So Satan is in rebellion towards God. So God says, oh, come over here and rebel against me here. Thank you. And Satan is still in rebellion, but God's just moving him, and he's moving the sinners, the Babylonians, throughout history. This is God moving through history. He's not okaying sin, but he's using evil and sin and darkness to accomplish his purpose. Does that make sense? And that helps you understand, why are certain people still in positions of power? Well, the simple answer is, God wants them there. Now, I may not know why. This is where the righteous will live by faith. Why are they still there? All I know is God's ultimately in control. They're still there. And here we are. So it's not like, well, it looks like God's lost control. No, God has not lost control. And God is good. So God's in control, and God is doing something good. It looks really bad. Right. The righteous will be righteous by faith. Now, there's one thing to step here as a Bible teacher and say, if you do this, God will do this. God promises he'll do this. But you come across, eventually you've got to cross this line into the secret things that we don't know, but we know some basics. So that's where you got to hold on to those basics. I mean, that's the base. You got to hold on to the basics, because eventually those basics are going to have to sustain you in the realm of the unknown. I can't explain. Why is this? And that, okay, we could go on and on and give examples. Let's continue. Verse 7. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. So here's dreaded. The descriptor is D-E-F-G. Dreaded. It means terrible, dreadful. The noun form is used to describe the terror created by the teeth of a crocodile. So if it was a noun, it's that terror that when you see the teeth of a crocodile, or when you see God, the presence of God, terror. They are when you start seeing these people come, they're bitter, they're hasty, they're marching across the earth, and they're taking whatever they want. Nothing's going to stop. They don't even feel guilty. They are, but they don't even feel it. And now they're at your door. It's like seeing the teeth of a crocodile or meeting the presence of God. Terror, they're dreaded. Fearsome, it means to fear. This terror is created by the trouble they bring. It's referring, this terror is, there's trouble and you're terrified of the trouble. Justice goes forth from themselves. It simply means they are autonomous. God will allow the Babylonians to determine and act on their own self-determined justice. So when Nebuchadnezzar says, you can't interpret my dream, the whole class of wise men are going to be executed. It's like, is that just? What do you mean? That's what I want. It's fair. It's what I want. And how would you know it's not fair? If someone could stop me, and no one can stop me. So it's fair. I'm the elite. You're the oppressed. Kill them. And so justice goes forth from themselves. And that's not just Nebuchadnezzar, that's the entire community. That is every soldier marching into Jerusalem. They're not under some accountability of what's right and what's wrong, what's just warfare. It's like, if I think it's right, and the only thing that's going to stop them is someone higher above them that's going to punish them for doing it. If Nebuchadnezzar says don't, they don't. Because guess what? He'll kill me. What's right and what's wrong? I just don't want to die. I just don't want to be punished. I don't want to be put in chains. So there's no court system. There's no justice. The justice comes from themselves. And if no one else is telling them what to do, they'll make the decision. Based on what? Their own sin nature. Dignity or exaltation goes forth from themselves. Meaning it means exaltation, dignity, swelling, and uprising. In other words, all of this, when they get done, they're bitter, they're hasty, marching across the earth, taking whatever they want, and they make their own decisions, and if they make a decision, they act on it. And at the end, it's like the success is because of me. It's because of me. It's because of my brilliant decision. What did you decide? Just to do it now. Just to be irresponsible, I'll just do it. It's like, and now they're growing and they're swelling, they're becoming more and more confident, becoming more bitter, more hasty, more aggressive, taking more stuff. It's intensifying. It's like now it's on steroids, and they're coming to your house, Habakkuk. Their horses, now here's their military. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. And again, that's all kind of self-explanatory. They're horses, but they're moving like they're riding leopards. Their horses are fierce like the evening wolves. I mean, like looking for prey. They're hunting. They're on the prowl. The horses are like this. And now we talk, their horsemen press on proudly. Proudly, I mean, again, they're proud of where they're going. The horsemen, now here, the horsemen and the cavalry are described as being proud, coming from afar. See that? They're horsemen. They come riding into your city, but they've come from the Euphrates. They've come from the other side of the Euphrates. They've been riding that horse since Babylon, up to Babylon, through across the Middle East, down now. It's like they just keep coming. Their horsemen are on great horses, as swift as leopards, like wolves, and these horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle and are swift to devour. And they came with one purpose. They don't come to negotiate. They came to devour. And those are the descriptors. The horsemen are described as pressing proudly on, come from afar, fly like an eagle or vulture. Chapter 1, verse 9. They all come for violence. They all come for Hamas. And I talked about that when we were going through the NIV. They all come, again, that's a superior attitude of we are a superior race, or we are a superior class of people, and the evil that we do, we don't call it evil, we call it our right because we're superior. They all come for violence. Now watch, they all face forward, all their faces forward. If you look down there, it's interesting, I'll just throw this to you. If you read the Hebrew starting on the right side, I read it backwards, they all for violence come. Okay, you see that? Then the next word, are set their faces like the east. So it doesn't say they all face forward. It says they all face east. Now, the idea there, and this is just in the basic ideal of the language development, I don't know which way is east here, so I do it right. In this room, which way is east? Is that east? That's east. See, I don't know. Okay, this is east. So the sun comes up here, and to face the sun, you're facing forward. Okay, and so to turn your back on the sun that's rising is to go away or be backwards. So to face forward would be, it doesn't mean they're riding their horses facing east, you know. It doesn't mean they're coming from the east, because they are coming from the east, but if they're facing east and they're following their horses, they'd be going the wrong way. It simply means, that's just the way they say it in the Hebrew, is to face east is to face forward. Okay, I just threw that. What's the theological meaning? It's just interpretation. So they all come for violence. They all face forward, meaning there's no retreating. There's no one in the army retreat. There's no cowards, meaning they're not abandoning. They're not retreating because they got defeated. Everybody is facing forward, and they're coming fast like leopards. So it's like there's no weakness. Where's the weak link? Where's the weak ranks? There's none. They just keep coming, and they're all coming forward. And they gather captives like sand. I mean, just like how you gather sand, it's meaningless. You're just scooping it up. And they're taking captives. Are they taking names? Are they keeping it in order? I mean, do you name the grains of sand? If you're collecting sand on a beach, if you're a kid collecting sand in a bucket, or if you're collecting sand to dump in with the concrete, are you naming the grains of sand? Are you counting the grains of sand? You're just by the scoopful. You're maybe, you know, weighing it pounds, you know, or scoops or buckets, you know, or camps. We got 10 camps of captives over there. Well, what are their names? Where do they come from? It's 10 camps. It's 10 buckets full. I don't know. We don't know their names. They're like sand. We're just going to leave them here and move on. Okay, now the kings, verse 10. At kings they scoff, at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth and take it. Again, right there, the word scoff, kings, it means to mock or scoff. So kings come out to negotiate, they're going to be mocked. They're going to be laughed at. There is no negotiation. There's no being intimidated by the kings. They laugh at them. It's like going to a, it's like sending a president to an international event and your president just gets mocked because it's like there's nothing there. And that's how they treat everybody. We're so much more superior than you. It's like we're not even listening. at rulers. The rulers could be princes, and usually refers to general government officials, not just the sons of the king, but it could include them. They laugh or scorn them. It means they become an object of derision. So the sons of the king, or the sons of the president, the son of the president, would be an object of derision or an object of ridicule and mockery. They just mock them. In every fortress, they laugh or deride. It means to laugh, to be amused. It means to make sport of. So they come to a fortress. Ooh, you know, let's see if we can do this in 20 minutes instead of an hour like last time. Let's see if we can take all three of these fortresses in one day instead of spending 2 days. It's like a game to them. It's for amusement. They use challenges like a fortified city, people's families and homes and businesses and entire cultures. They use it as a form of entertainment. They're just bored. They're rash, bored, and just using this. They're mocking kings, laughing at princes, and being taking a challenge. How far can we throw these, you know, javelins? How many stones can we throw? Anyway, that's what they're doing. Then they pile up earth or heap up earth mounds. That refers to the siege ramps very clearly. 2 Kings chapter 19 and also Isaiah 37, it says this. Let me just read this. Heaps of earth refers to the siege ramps the Assyrians and Babylonians would build up against the city's walls. Now we're talking here in Jeremiah 6:6. I'll jump to that one. For thus says the Lord of hosts, cut down her trees, cast up a siege mound against Jerusalem. This is the city that must be punished. There is nothing but oppression within her. Now that's Jeremiah's ministry, right along time as Habakkuk's ministry, same time period, talking about the Babylonians. And God, through Jeremiah, is giving the command to cut down the trees. And they're going to cut down the trees to use them for siege ramps or siege machinery or for structures, so the dirt doesn't continue to fall away. You pile up the dirt, you've got to put down trees, trunks to hold it up. In fact, when we march up Masada, walked up the ramp, the Roman siege ramp that they built to go up to the top of Masada, an incredible feat. They just stopped and took months to build this thing. You can still see, and I was so tempted, but I knew I shouldn't. You could still see, you could walk on it, and of course, it's kind of eroded away a little bit, but you could see sticking out on the ends all the way up, lumber, big chunks of lumber sticking out, and it would be a log going all the way through that siege ramp where they'd build it up, and then they'd put down logs and stabilize those logs, and then put dirt so it wouldn't slide down. The log would hold it in place, and of course, I wanted to just kind of, you know, take a chunk of the log off and bring it home and put it in my little collection. But I knew I'd probably end up in some prison somewhere in the Middle East. So I just took a picture. That's what they do. They cut down trees. Anyway, that's what God is saying to them in Jeremiah 6. Cut down the trees and cast up siege mounds against Jerusalem. God is giving them the command, build siege ramps against my city. And Sennacherib writes himself about his destruction of the fortified cities. This is the Assyrians. He says, I besieged 46 of Hezekiah's fortified walled cities. This is Sennacherib now talking about what he had written. Now, he wrote this himself, inscribed it on in cuneiform. I besieged 46 of Hezekiah's fortified walled cities using packed down ramps and applying battering rams, infantry attacks by mines, breaches, and siege machines. And you can see some pictures of that. Well, here, I've got pictures here. Turn the page. And this is now, again, very quickly, just some pictures. This is all Assyrian. The top picture on page 6, I took this picture at Lachish. And that structure is at Lachish, and that was built by Sennacherib's military building a siege ramp up against the wall. And the siege ramp is still seen there. The ramp can be seen in the Assyrian reliefs. Now, if you look down below the picture, this now is a picture I took in the British Museum, the picture on the bottom of page 6, and that is the Battle of Lachish. The same place that's a picture above. And you can see the Jews in that little tower. See, they got little circles, little shields around there. And there's a guy hanging over the wall shooting an arrow. Can you see that? This was carved on Sennacherib's palace in Nineveh on his wall after the battle at Lachish. So you've got the picture of the wall or the siege ramp he built. Then you've got a picture of an action photo of the actual battle that was on his wall. And you can see there, coming up like a little road, little going at an angle, almost a little more than a 45-degree angle, probably a little steeper. You can see there's a little bit of a house there. It's going to have, you can't necessarily see the wheels, but there, and there's a long spear sticking out. That is the siege engine being rolled up the siege ramps to bang on the walls of Lachish. So that is the siege ramp. Also, you can see some people on the right side going down a ramp. And those are people, see, there's a lot of things going on top of each other in this picture. Those are people with their bags over their shoulder, and they're walking out of the city. So you've got people on top fighting. You've got the Assyrians coming up the siege ramp. And then you've got people being escorted out of the city. They're going into captivity or dispersion. Those are Jews leaving their city of Lachish with their possessions. If you could see another picture further down on this wall that's there, you've actually got a cart with wooden wheels and a lady driving the cow or the ox with just tons of stuff in the cart and two or three little children sitting in the seat with her. And then her husband is out front carrying luggage and they're on their way into captivity. And so they're being taken off. Anyway, you can also see, looking at that, you can see the little square stones. Those are sling stones being thrown up at the Jews on the wall. And then those things that look like logs or something, you can see on the end of them, on one of the ends, they're like little strings. That's the flames. Those are torches being thrown down out of the wall of Lachish at the wooden siege engines to try and set them on fire. And if you get a closer picture of another siege engine, there's a guy inside the city. There's a guy up front driving it. There's some people backside pulling it or pushing it, and they've got shields around them. And then there's a guy in the siege engine, and he's got like this cup. And what it is, he's got a bucket, and he's got a cup, and he's pouring water on the siege engine. Because they've got a wooden siege engine coming up the ramp. The Jews from Lachish are throwing these torches down at the siege engine, trying to set it on fire. And there's a guy on the siege engine, his job is the fire putter outer. And he's dumping water on the fire on the siege engine. That's all taking place in that picture. Okay, turn the page. There's a picture of the slingers. And then you can see, but the picture below, you can see they've all got their sling stones and their slings. And they're just, I mean, that's just one stone. They're not like taking one shot and walking away. It's like all day long, the slingers are slinging until it's break time. So when you're under assault, it's just like boom, 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 boom. It's like a hailstorm that just won't quit until the wall breaks. And then the picture below, you can see the slingers, but in front of them, their archers are shooting arrows. And again, notice there's not just one guy shooting arrows or everybody shoots one arrow and goes home for the day. They've got just arrow after arrow. People are supplying them with arrows. It's raining rocks and arrows all day long when they attack a city. That was the Assyrians. Okay, I'm on page 8 now. The last verse tonight, chapter 1, verse 11. Then they sweep by like the wind and go on. I mean, they've come to a city, they've taken what they've wanted, they've terrorized it in their arrogance, and they move on. And they just like the wind. They're just like wind comes in and goes, it's like it's gone. I mean, right today it was windy, the wind's moved on, now it's calm. They've gone, they've got everything they want, and they've moved on. They're just sweeping across the earth. They're under God's control in a sense. He in a sense is, you know, not necessarily directing them, but he's allowing them to just run rampant. And again, it says guilty men. God says, he ends, they're guilty. They are flat out guilty, but I'm not going to stop them. Whose own might is their God. Now notice this, we'll quit with this. Whose own might is their God. That's a translation. And the NIV says, guilty men whose own strength is their God. It's in agreement. The NIV and the English Standard Version is in agreement. And it's a tough thing to translate. If you look right here, look at the Hebrew, if you don't mind, again, read that backwards. Then changes his mind and he transgresses. See, instead of saying, see how that's weird, isn't it? Then they sweep by like the wind and go on, is the English Standard Version. The transliteration, or the translation from the Hebrew in the interlinear is, then changes his mind and he transgresses. And, you know, now you're into a tough verse. People are struggling with what this verse means. sweeps by like the wind and goes on, then changes the mind and transgresses. Changes means to pass on or away or pass through. And here I was really typing fast, so I'm making mistakes. And it wasn't underlining anything. Transgresses is the word a bar. I didn't even italicize it. Means to pass over, pass through, or pass by. So they're putting that together. The guilty man is pretty standard. But then the phrase, own might is their God, or ascribing this power to his God. See, so it could be their one translation is their own might is their God. So they go through, they give themselves credit for all these victories, all this plunder, and that is their God. They, in a sense, worship their own efforts. The other way of translating it, ascribing this power that they have, this success, to their God, is another way of translating it. So again, that's a tough way of translating. What we do know is the facts of the inscriptions that the Babylonians, like the Assyrians, were notorious for giving their gods credit. They thought that if they have violated the gods, they have set the gods, they were in big trouble. They would lose wars because maybe they forgot an offering somewhere. The gods were not gods that established moral codes. They were gods that handed out favors if you served them. So whatever the gods wanted, you just gave it to them because the gods would give you something. That's a pagan religion. So it's hard to understand this translation, whose own might is their God. That may be right, but we know that they gave their gods credit, at least, you know, verbal. Maybe in their hearts they thought it was themselves, but they were definitely honoring their gods for their success. So that's kind of a tough way of ending it. And this, again, this was God speaking. He says, then they sweep by like the wind, go on, guilty men whose own might is their God. Now, that's how God... Now, notice what God did. He says, I'm going to tell you what I'm doing. You're going to be utterly amazed. You won't believe if you were told. I'm raising up the Babylonians. And then he describes, that's all he does then, is describe what kind of people he's bringing to Habakkuk City. And Habakkuk is, again, I mean, you can't get more wicked than, I mean, you can't describe a more wicked attitude than bitter, hasty, a law unto themselves, taking whatever they want and not feeling guilty because it's Hamas. They have superiority. We just deserve whatever we want. It's like, that's absolute wickedness. And so Habakkuk, of course, is going to be in verse 12. Oh, Lord, are you not from me? It's like, oh, Lord. I mean, you ever heard anybody say, oh, Lord? That would be, it's like, oh, Lord. I mean, it's like, I had no idea. Aren't you from everlasting? No, I don't understand this. And Habakkuk is now going to have to respond, and he's going to bring up you talk about quoting Bible and quoting Moses. He's going to quote all of God's character traits, and you can't let this happen because this is not who you are. And then God, and he's going to, really what we're looking for is God's second answer in chapter 2, verse 2, where he's going to say, now I'm going to explain something to you that, you know, he doesn't say it here, but in a sense, it's never been understood before. I'm going to give you a revelation. I'm going to reveal to you what is going on in the big picture. And that's kind of what we're heading for. So anyway, I'll quit with that. Thank you for coming. I'll pray, and we are finished. Father, we do thank you again for your word. We thank you for the opportunity to look into these things. We ask that we would handle these things diligently so we'd have a clear perspective of how to evaluate our own times. We do realize that there are always going to be things we do not understand, but we do want to definitely understand the things that have been revealed to us and pay particular attention to them as we seek you and seek your guidance. Father, we do thank you for these things and ask that you bring them to light in our lives and let us manifest your character. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you again for being here.